You're listening to Central Time. I'm Dean Kinetter, in today for Rob Ferret. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court announced something of a first a week ago. The justices released a code of conduct document, stating that while the court has been following common law ethics rules from a variety of sources, quote, the absence of a code has led in recent years to the misunderstanding that the justices of this court, unlike all other jurists in this country, regard themselves as unrestricted by ethics rules, unquote. That announcement, though, didn't come until after reporting from ProPublica about luxury travel by some justices and other campaigns to influence the court, which were previously undisclosed. Add to the mix pressure from Senate Democrats related to transparency and ethics rules. We're going to get into what all the justices included in this ethics code and what's missing. You can join in, too, at 800-642-1234. How ethical do you see the Supreme Court as being as of late? Do you think they need to codify a set of ethical guidelines? What questions do you have about what's in this code, what's not in it? What's your response to the court issuing this code of ethics? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Sarah Benesch is associate professor and chair of the Political Science Department at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, where she researches judicial decision-making and court legitimacy. Sarah, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, what was your reaction when this ethics code came out from the court about a week ago?
Well, I think there's some cause to be, you know, sort of excited about the fact that the court was listening. So it certainly heard complaints by politicians, concerns raised by the public, and commentators' criticisms of the court's lack or seeming lack of some ethical guidelines. And so the fact that they responded is a big deal. But I think when you read the actual statement and the actual code, you come away a little bit maybe less impressed with their work.
Yeah. What do you think is, first off, what's missing from this document?
Well, I think it's, you know, it's clearly the case that there's no enforcement mechanism here. So the Supreme Court has not offered us any way to make a complaint or allowed any other lawyer or justice to make a complaint against another justice for behaving in ways that are contrary to the code. So that's, I think, the first thing that you notice. I think the second thing, though, is, and maybe this is the first thing you notice, is right on the front, there's this little statement, and you quoted from it in your introduction. And the statement reads to me as sort of a, okay, you're complaining, and we hear you complaining, and so here's what we've already been doing, and stop misunderstanding, you know, our actions. And so it reads as a very sort of, I don't know, I want to say maybe condescending a bit. Saying that, you know, the Supreme Court should be trusted to do these things, and oh, some people are complaining, and so we're going to put some of these things in writing.
And could you talk a bit more about what you see as the motivations for the court to create this document? Why right now?
Well, as you mentioned, the Senate is talking about these ethics considerations, and we're considering some subpoenas for some of the supporters of Thomas and Alito that have led to some of those problematic relationships. And so I think that, you know, they are seeing the political action in Congress. I think they also have concerns about the separation of powers, and some of those concerns may be warranted. And so they wanted to act before Congress attempted to act to constrain their behavior. And then I do think that, you know, especially the Chief Justice, but all the justices are concerned with their legitimacy. And so it seems as if this is a bit of a reaction to some pretty low poll numbers that the court has been experiencing for the last term or so. And I think this is sort of a way to try to allay the concerns of public about their behavior and to sort of put these kinds of allegations and concerns to rest so that people can start to trust the institution again.
And it is pretty rare for there to be a unanimous decision of any kind from the Supreme Court these days. But here, all the justices are signing on to this code of ethics. What do you make of that that consensus from the justices?
Yeah, I think the unanimous nature is important. I think they had to come out with a statement that they all agreed with. But I also think that that's likely why some of the statement is much more vague than it might have been had there been, you know, some dissensus allowed. So, you know, there a lot of the words in the statement, for example, talk about, should rather than shall. Some of the words talk about using specific things as guidance. And so I think the vague wording of a lot of the code, although it relies pretty heavily on the lower court code, but some of the wording I think is likely a result of that desire for consensus. And so when you want to have a document that all nine can sign on to, you might have to have a document that's a little less specific than maybe some of the justices would have preferred.
We're talking with Sarah Benesch right now, associate professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at UW-Milwaukee, looking at a newly released Code of Ethics from the U.S. Supreme Court. We're also taking your calls at 800-642-1234. And let's go to the phones right now. We have Ted with us in Monaco. Hi, Ted.
I think it's well documented throughout history that the Supreme Court, not only being the last word of the law, the most trusted branch, they definitely have always been the most ethical branch of government. And the idea of the Senate, where all the, overlooked insider trading and all the outright crime in the executive branch, the idea of some other body of government trying to impose, they're the one that started this, to get rules on the Supreme Court, that's a joke. And it's just some propagandist trying to change the subject because they don't agree with some recent Supreme Court rulings.
Ted, thanks for the call. And Ted's right. Supreme Court, not the only branch of government that faces concerns about corruption and ethics. Sarah, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that's true. Oftentimes when we criticize the Supreme Court, the real criticism is that we don't like the decisions that they're making. It's less about the process and procedure. And there are, as I mentioned, separation of powers concerns. And so the Supreme Court is the court of last resort. There is no authority that can overturn its decisions. And so, we probably can't expect the court to cede control over its activities outside of the bench to one of the other co-equal branches. I think that separation of powers argument was very important to the Supreme Court, which is another reason why they got ahead of Congress. But I also think there's some real concerns about ethics violations here, especially when we have an unelected body that has life tenure, right? So if we're upset with some of the problems in Congress, we can vote them out, right? We can't do that with the Supreme Court. And I think, frankly, people have higher expectations for the Supreme Court in terms of their honesty and ethics.
And some of the incidents that were reported on by ProPublica and other outlets had to do with Clarence Thomas, Samuel Alito, accepting luxury travel and gifts from conservative donors. And that was part of the impetus for people really pushing for some kind of ethics code from the Supreme Court. Does this new ethics code laid out by the court address those kind of instances? Would it do anything about that?
I think it does, yeah. I think the code says explicitly that the Supreme Court is going to abide by those lower court codes from the judicial conference. And part of the judicial conference's codes talk about the disclosure of financial gifts. And in fact, it recently made a revision in reaction to some of these questions about the justices to define what personal hospitality means. So there's a exemption to reporting requirements for what they call personal hospitality. And so the question, especially in the Justice Thomas case, was whether or not personal hospitality extended to something like a luxury cruise or a stay at a luxury resort. And so the judicial conference has decided that what they mean by personal hospitality is the justices don't have to disclose when they go over to a friend's house for dinner. We want them to be able to have normal lives and lead, public normal lives. But it does not exempt from disclosure the kinds of trips that Justice Thomas went on, or the kinds of trips that Justice Alito went on. And so I think it's implicitly saying that what they did should have been disclosed. But certainly, again, there's no enforcement mechanism here, so there's no going back. The code only applied to the Supreme Court once it decided it applied to the Supreme Court. And so to the extent that those behaviors are problematic, they're sort of outside the purview of this new guidance.
And as I read through this document that's been put out by the court, I see the word should a lot. Mm-hmm. And I am not a legal expert, but I imagine that justices choose their words pretty carefully. Is that use of the word should rather than shall or must significant?
Yes. The language in this whole code of conduct is significant because it is, you know, as we talked about, a unanimous document that ends up then, because of the unanimity, being a little bit vague and a little bit careful with some of its language. So should and shall is a big distinction, right? So when you say someone should do something or ought to do something, that's much different than saying that someone shall do something. And so there's a lot of room throughout the document for justice choices, and a lot of focus on knowingly engaging in certain behaviors. And so there's a section on financial interests. And so instead of just, you know, sort of saying if there's a financial interest, the justices may not sit on a case, it says that if the justices knowingly engage with a case in which they have a conflict, you know, so there's this sort of additional question, not only of should they have gotten involved, but also did they know specifically that they were getting involved in something that they potentially had a conflict on.
We're talking about what prompted the new code of conduct the Supreme Court released just last week and what's in it. Sarah Benish is our guest. She's associate professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at UW-Milwaukee. We want you to be part of the conversation too at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest? What's your perception of the Supreme Court these days? Does this new ethics code move the needle on that at all? Do you think it's necessary or is it not needed? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Kinetter. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Sarah Benish, associate professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at UW-Milwaukee. We're talking about a new ethics code the Supreme Court justices formally adopted last week. We're also taking your comments, your questions at 800-642-1234. Let us know if you think there's a need for an ethics policy by the Supreme Court. How do you feel about the High Court these days? Do you have faith in the justices? That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Let's go back to the phones now. We have Nancy with us in Milwaukee. Hi, Nancy.
Hello. I'm calling to say that in the last 2 years, I read an article in the Milwaukee Journal about the fact that the justices at any time can redecorate their offices, including the purchase of any kind of office furniture or equipment they feel they need, and including specially made draperies for the windows. They can do this without having to go through any kind of a bidding process. They just find what they want and buy it, and it's paid for. And this article also pointed out the fact that there are large rooms within the justice building that they rent out for anniversary parties of all kinds, small conventions, weddings, birthday parties, anything they want. They charge the kinds of rent they want, and they get to keep the money, and none of this is passing through any set of financial books. And when I read that article, it made me even more a disillusioned American citizen than I already was.
Nancy, thank you for the call. Sarah, is that something you know about? And what do we know about ethics for personal office expenses for the court?
I don't know much about that, unfortunately, no. I know that the new code of conduct does talk about use of the chambers for things other than judicial duties, it seems fairly negative about using them for anything but writing opinions and working on cases. But the actual oral argument chamber of the court is sometimes used in some ceremonial sort of extrajudicial ways, and that has gotten some attention in the past as well. So Justice Thomas, for example, holds the Horatio Alger Association induction there. And that's a big, you know, draw for people who are members of that society. And that has been questioned as being potentially problematic in terms of ethics.
Nancy, thanks for that call. And Sarah, we mentioned earlier how this code of conduct helps to define the personal hospitality aspect that we discussed earlier. Are there other things that are significant in here that you see this code laying out that the justices can't do?
I think the Chief Justice or the unanimous court, I guess, altogether lays out that a lot of the things in this code of conduct are not new. And I think that's fair. I think a lot of the items in the code of conduct are items that have always existed in terms of their application to lower court judges. And what the court is doing now is saying, okay, the Supreme Court will also be bound by these various conduct sort of guidelines. But I think what's, I think we focus a little bit on that financial activities section with the personal hospitality and with financial disclosures. But there's also a very big piece of the code of conduct that is devoted to recusal decisions. And that's a pretty big deal in courts as well, where judges and justices decide for themselves whether or not they can impartially participate in a particular case given, some sort of perceived or real conflict of interest. And so that section of the code of conduct is an important section, and it's also relatively distinguished from the same section that applies to lower court judges.
Another issue people have been talking about in the past couple of years regarding the court is the activity of spouses, particularly because Ginni Thomas, wife of Clarence Thomas, longtime conservative activist and organizer, we've seen her name attached to communications with the White House on January 6th. Is there anything in this code of ethics about spouses?
Yes, there are some pieces of the code that talk about financial disqualification and about recusal that do relate to conflicts of interest that spouses hold. There's nothing in there about that would sort of pertain to Ginni Thomas's political action, but there are some aspects of the code that apply to the justice, but also to the justice's immediate family, including spouse, children, parents, and so on.
And this code, Sarah, as we mentioned, doesn't have a lot of enforcement teeth written into it. I'm curious, though, what could that look like? What could a hypothetical enforcement mechanism look like for a code of ethics for the highest court in the country?
I don't know. I think that's tricky. To the degree that some of the aspects of the code of conduct are based on U.S. statutes, it is, potentially possible for the attorney general to bring charges. Now, that's probably never going to happen and never has happened in the past. And because the statutes don't explicitly often refer to the Supreme Court and its justices, that would be, there'd only be a very limited place for that kind of an enforcement. And so what the court suggests in this document is that they will rely on the guidance of various bodies, including their Office of Legal Counsel and the Judicial Conference and the various subcommittees of the Judicial Conference. So I think, a lot of legal scholars have been sort of thinking about ways in which the court's ethics could be, or their code of conduct could be implemented. And as we said at the outset, it's really difficult with separation of powers issues, unless the court were to create some sort of an ethics committee where claims or questions about disclosure or about recusal could go to that committee. Any other solution really kind of runs into these questions of separation of powers.
And you mentioned earlier, Sarah, that public trust in the court has been falling for a while. We've seen that in polling here in Wisconsin and nationwide, and that predates reporting on hospitality activities from Thomas, Alito, et cetera. Do you think this code of ethics is likely to move the needle on that public trust issue?
I think it depends on how widely the code of ethics is covered. So I think it's great that you're talking about it on your program. I think it's really hard for the public to keep up with events in government. And this could be seen as a very sort of specific and esoteric sort of question, right? Whether or not the Supreme Court has a code of ethics might not be something that plays really strongly across the electorate. So we've seen some legitimacy losses at the Supreme Court. We've seen confidence lower than it's been for a long time. Generally speaking, scholars attribute that to politicization and to political polarization. And I think those explanations for the Supreme Court's lagging numbers are probably a little bit more compelling than an explanation based on ethics. Although, you know, it's been recent enough that we don't have a whole lot of poll data on whether or not people are adversely impacted by these stories about wealthy donors and so forth and the interaction of justices with them. So, you know, I guess the main thing is that, you know, we have to think about what the public is likely to hear and engage with. And the public writ large may not be particularly interested in a code of ethics for the Supreme Court. It might not be something that's really salient to them.
And what are you keeping your eye on next, Sarah, when it comes to either reaction to this code or ethical issues facing the court?
I think we've already seen some change in response to these new understandings of reporting requirements. And I think that's a positive development. You know, so Thomas has recused in a case involving January 6th. Thomas has also disclosed some trip information that he hadn't disclosed before. And so it's possible that the existence of the code and the discussion of the code and this sort of, you know, conscious awareness of the impact of Supreme Court behavior or the potential impact of Supreme Court behavior on the way people see the institution could have a really positive effect in the long term, keeping the justices just sort of in a self-enforcement kind of way, more aware of the activities that they're engaging in and what those might look like outside the court.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. But Sarah, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome. Anytime.
Sarah Benesch is Associate Professor and Chair of the Department of Political Science at UW-Milwaukee. We talked with her about what prompted the U.S. Supreme Court to adopt a formal code of conduct last week, what's in it, and what questions still remain about how it will be enforced. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, the State Geological and Natural History Survey gives us some important data about our shared resources, including groundwater. We'll hear from the new state geologist about what's at the top of her agenda. Plus, two economic development leaders join the show from northern Wisconsin. That's coming up tomorrow morning after 7 o'clock on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Today is Funky Drummer Day. We're celebrating the anniversary of the most sampled music track of all time being recorded in 1970. That's James Brown's Funky Drummer. Specifically, it's the drum beat by Clyde Stubblefield. He joined the JBs in 1965 and laid down some of the greatest funk beats of all time. And for almost 50 years, before his death in 2017, he lived and performed in Madison, Wisconsin. The Funky Drummer has been sampled hundreds of times and helped create the sound for hip-hop and rap. You'll know it when you hear it.
One, two, three, four, get it!
Listening to Central Time, I'm Dean Kinetter, in today for Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk with the author of a book about healing from illness and injury and the lost art of rest and recovery. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Sarah Hopeful with a story about hunting, just as many Wisconsinites spent their weekend in the woods.
Deer hunters across the state are gearing up for another gun season opener with hopes of getting that big buck. For writer Ron Weber, it's not about the catch, but the opportunity the day provides.
Opening day 2022, deep in the heart of the Shawamigan-Nicolet National Forest near Clam Lake in Bayfield County. Scattered gunshots greet the daylight, heightening the excitement unique to opening morning. Only time would tell what waited for me down the trail. As the shots become more infrequent and the morning wears on, a hint of doubt enters my mind as I think to myself, maybe I should have sat somewhere else. Suddenly at about 10 a.m., a deer materializes, seemingly out of nowhere. The doe is moving quickly, but why? There are no other hunters nearby, so maybe it is an over-anxious buck that has her in such a hurry. As I wait for the answer, in my mind's eye, a big rack buck steps out of the spruce swamp. That vision keeps me company for the next hour. The afternoon is uneventful, save for two separate periods of 20 minutes or so of absolute silence. It is rare that nature and man conspire to make such an offer. No gunshots, car horns, blue jays, ravens, squirrels, or other usual denizens of the woods. Even the wind falls still. I strain my ears trying to hear something, but there is only deafening silence. As the curtain falls on another opening day, I climb out of my stand with nothing to show for 10.5 hours of sitting, but an empty lunch bag, two great silences, a doe sighted, and the vision of a trophy buck stepping out of the spruce. Like all the opening days before, it had been a memorable day. Did I say nothing to show for my time in the woods? What more could I have asked for? Did I get my deer? Does it really matter? I'll paraphrase the great Wisconsin conservationist Ulla Leopold to answer that question. What was big was not the rack, but the chance. What was full was not my tag, but my memory. That comes from Leopold's A Sand County Almanac, a book every hunter, no check that every person should read. It can change one's view of the natural world and their place in it. No, I didn't get my deer, but there is always the next day, the next year. The 12 months between opening days is a necessary interlude to heighten the anticipation for the coming of that one special day each year. It has the power to remind even us adults of the magical feeling of a child awaiting a visit from Santa on Christmas Eve. As the days shorten and the sun's warmth begins to wane, all of nature takes note. Animals are busily packing on weight or stocking their shelves in anticipation of the coming winter. Plants similarly go dormant or die. The green of spring and summer steadily receding, culminating in one final and glorious burst of color before the more steely, stark landscape of November takes hold. Hunters take notice too, as that special day looms just weeks away. Just when the anticipation becomes almost unbearable, it finally arrives. Come opening day, I will be just where I've always been since I was 13, in the big woods of southern Bayfield County, waiting to write the next chapter in the story. Too excited to sleep very well, I will arise early and get myself ready. Walking in the pre-dawn darkness, vision of what awaits for me will flash through my mind. Settled in with my back against a tree, I will wait patiently and thankfully for whatever gifts the hand of fate offers. If it can't be the buck that lives in the shadowy spruce of my mind, then this once upon a time kid will gladly welcome a visit from Santa instead.
Ron Weber is a writer who lives in Weyerhaeuser. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Sarah Hopeful.
Now, when we get injured or ill, we're often counting down the days until we can get back to our normal routine. Whether that pressure comes from limited sick days, deadlines, or just stubborn self-reliance, we rarely take the full amount of time needed to completely heal. Our next guest is here to teach us some about the healing process and how we can make the most out of our time spent recovering. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you or a loved one gone through the process of recovering from an illness, an injury, a traumatic event? What was it like? Did you feel like you had to go back to work before you should have? What's been helpful in your recovery? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Gavin Francis is a primary care physician and author of the new book, Recovery, The Lost Art of Convalescence. Gavin, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me along, Dean.
Well, the title of your book refers to recovery as a lost art. And as I started reading, I realized that we really have lost something in terms of the way that recovery is thought about as part of the medical process. Can you talk about how it was treated and talked about differently in the past?
Yes, of course. So my own medical training didn't really mention recovery or convalescence. You couldn't see them in the index of the textbooks that I had to study at medical school. But I think that's because in the last 50 years or so of the 20th century, we had so many fantastic medical interventions, wonderful drugs and surgical innovations, that we began to think that all you need is the right kind of technology or the right kind of drug. But, you know, there's much older traditions of recovery. We used to be much better at taking the time to recover that you really needed. And we used to have a culture that really valued and gave respect to that process. And maybe that was because we didn't have all the fancy drugs. We didn't have all the technology. And so we had to rely on more traditional methods. And I think my own experience has shown that with modern medicine, it's wonderful. You know, I wouldn't want to be without it. But we really have lost something in terms of that respect we used to give to the process.
And what were you seeing in your experience as a doctor or just as a person that made you realize, hey, something's missing here. We need to focus a little more on the recovery side of things.
Yeah, often as a physician, I'll see a patient with, you know, just take, for example, a pneumonia, like a significant chest infection, something that could really lay somebody low for a while. And I'll prescribe them some antibiotics after examining them. And then sometimes a week later, I'll get a phone call and the patient will say, hey, doc, I've finished those antibiotics, but I'm not completely better. And I would say, well, I wouldn't expect you to be completely better yet. You know, it takes a while. Your body's got to recover. You might have killed off the infection, but your body's been weakened and it's going to take some time. And similarly, do you know, people who, for example, might go for orthopedic surgery, you know, they fall, they break a bone, they're taken into hospital, they get the bone screwed back together or metal plates put in, and then they get very frustrated when they can't immediately go back to normal. And I have to say, well, that's the bone put back together, but actually the process is going to take a while. It's going to be weeks, sometimes months. And if you engage with that process and you give that process respect, then you recover much, much better rather than just feeling impatient about it.
Yeah, in your book, you write that, I'm quoting here, illness is not simply a matter of biology, but one of psychology and sociology. Could you talk a bit more about how those elements factor into a recovery?
Yeah, of course. I mean, a huge part of how we recover is what our expectations are. So what we expect to happen often becomes kind of self-fulfilling. So a huge part for me of being a good doctor is trying to figure out what my patient most has faith in and what they expect to happen and trying to either gently modify that belief or take advantage of it. You know, a really good example of that, just the power of our expectations, is the placebo effect. You know, with so many drugs have been tested against placebos, which are essentially blank pills. But we know that if you have a blue placebo, that's more likely to make you feel sleepy or tired. If you have a red placebo, that's more likely to work well as a painkiller. We know that capsule placebos work better than tablets. So people have beliefs about things that they take, things that they're prescribed, and they can have really profound effects on the way that they feel. I wonder if there's an attitude thing here too, because I'm thinking of one story I tell in the book about two patients of mine, two men who both suffered from heart attacks, both of them collapsed. Both of them were resuscitated and brought back to life and then had defibrillators put in their chest, implantable defibrillators that you carry and wear. But it was really amazing to me how one of these men experienced that really terrifying ordeal as a kind of rebirth. You know, he felt that he'd cheated death and he'd been given extra years, and he went on to have these glorious few years, really enjoying and savoring every moment of his life. Whereas the other man found the whole experience terrifying, felt very fragile, felt very vulnerable, felt very frightened of what might happen to him. And his life was diminished as a result. And that's a really good example, I think, of how the same event can have massively different meanings and different consequences depending on our state of mind, on our attitudes.
We're talking with Dr. Gavin Francis right now, physician and author of the book Recovery, The Lost Art of Convalescence. We're talking about the healing process, how we could do it better, how we could give ourselves more time to properly recover from illness or injury. We want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. Have you had to go through a long recovery from an illness or an injury? Do you have a chronic condition that requires a lot of rest and healing time? How are you able to fit that into your life? What difficulties do you face? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Dean Kinetter. We're continuing our talk with Dr. Gavin Francis, physician and author of the book Recovery, The Lost Art of Convalescence. We're talking about the process of healing and how to make the most of it. You can join in at 800-642-123 with your experiences, your questions about recovery and healing. That's 800-642-1234. And Gavin, one thing I think of when I hear long recovery lately is long COVID, which is something that's kind of tough to pin down, but has very real symptoms and consequences. Has seeing patients with some form of long COVID impacted, you know, your thoughts on this topic of recovery?
Yeah, of course, Dean. I mean, as a general physician, I see patients with all kinds of long-term conditions. And, you know, when we say long COVID, we have to know what it is exactly that we're talking about. You know, for some people, the consequences of COVID is that they remain very breathless for a long time. It seems that they can't catch their breath. For other people, it's just their smell that never came back. Other people become very, very fatigued, exhausted, with very kind of minimal effort. And so there's lots of different consequences of this illness. But as a primary care doctor, I've known people for a long time who have post-viral fatigue. Do you know, we know a little bit about the history of medicine. We can go back even a couple of thousand years. There's accounts of people with high fever, illness, breathlessness, who then become very fatigued. So this is a very ancient condition too, although it's still not one that's particularly well understood. But when I sit down with a patient who's suffering with really difficult fatigue after their COVID, what I can talk to them about is different kinds of techniques that have helped other patients of mine in the past, different kinds of physical therapy kind of approaches. And we can also rule out other kinds of conditions that cause exhaustion. You know, we can rule out thyroid problems. We can rule out anemia and low iron. We can rule out lots of other things. And so even though long COVID itself is very poorly understood, there's still quite a lot that can be done to make people feel better.
And as you point out in your book, sometimes taking all the time we might need isn't always practical, especially if you have a job that's wanting you back. You might miss out on income. And here in America, we are much less likely to take sick time than in some other countries. What do you see as, I guess, some of the obstacles right now for everyone being able to truly take those recovery periods that they need?
Yeah, it's difficult. There's a lot of economic factors, of course, and not everyone is in the same position of being able to take the work they need, the time they need off work. I mean, perhaps, for example, you have an arrangement or a job which doesn't let you take any sick leave, or it lets you take it but cuts your pay. It's been shown that the average European country, people take about double the amount of sick leave than people take in the United States. And I'm sure that's not because the people in Europe are necessarily more lazy or that they take longer to recover. I'm sure that it's to do with the availability of paid leave. So I always try and encourage people where they can to try and be kind to themselves. If they feel they need to take that extra time, then they should explore every possible way they can to be able to take that. Because my own experience suggests that if you do take the time to really recover properly, then you recover much better and you're less likely to relapse. But it's a very tricky problem, as you say, and I really feel for a lot of people who are in an economic position where they can't take that time.
Mm-hmm. And recovery is going to look a lot different whether, you know, you have a broken leg or a viral illness or perhaps a mental health crisis. Is there a common thread for people to kind of know when they're ready, when they feel healed and recovered?
Well, do you know, there was the World Health Organization many decades ago put out a definition of health that was really quite extreme. It said that health was the complete absence of any kind of social, physical, or mental problem. It said it was complete social, mental, and physical well-being. And my own view is that's incredibly rare. Do you know, if that's our definition of health, then almost nobody is healthy. And so I think it's much more helpful to think of health as a balance between different kinds of extremes, and that it means different things for different people, and it means different things for the same person at different stages of life. Do you know, for what health means to an 18-year-old is very different to what health means to an 80-year-old. So I try to help patients find out what the best balance of health is for them. It might not be perfect, but we try and see what is possible. And sometimes it's better to think about what is possibly the best situation to get into rather than what is the perfect situation to get into. And as you say, Dean, that's very different with mental health problems versus different kinds of physical problems.
And something we hear a lot about is chronic pain and chronic illness. And I imagine that mindset of finding the best possible solution might fit with people that have recurring illnesses.
Yeah, absolutely. Because modern medicine is wonderful at quietening down different kinds of illness. It's wonderful at palliating and softening and mitigating and making things easier. But actually, if you look at the list of illnesses that humans can suffer and you look at how many of those we can definitively cure, it's not actually that long a list. Medicine is very good at helping with symptoms, but there's a lot of things we can't cure. But I would encourage people who are struggling with chronic pain or chronic illness still not to lose heart or to lose hope, because there's often still many things that can be done. And I often try and imagine my job as a way of helping people ease their suffering, but also helping people to live with a bit more autonomy, a bit more dignity than they might otherwise be doing. So even if we can't cure an illness, we can still help people to live more fulfilled lives or easier lives.
Let's go to the phones right now. We have John with us in Appleton. Hi, John.
Yes, hi. 7 weeks ago, I had a full knee replacement. And on my two-week follow-up, they were amazed how well I was doing. I had nearly normal flexibility. And I'd have to say the reason for that was I was 95% either in bed or in my recliner, just taking it easy. And now I'm able to walk with pretty much normal. It's just a matter of steps. I need to get my muscle strength back, and steps are still, a little gimpy. But other than that, people are amazed how well I am doing.
John, love to hear it. Thanks for letting us know about that. And Dr. Francis, it sounds like John was getting the proper rest.
Yeah, absolutely. And a knee, recovering from knee surgery is a really good example of a kind of recovery that you can see how things are progressing. You just glance down at your leg, you can slowly see the muscle come back. You can see the tone. You can feel your balance coming back. It's a kind of recovery which is different in a way from recovering from something like what we were talking about earlier, long COVID, where it can be much more difficult to feel the edges of what constitutes recovery. It can feel much more difficult to be sure that we're really fully recovered. But no, I congratulate him. That's brilliant. Well done, John.
Yeah, John, thanks for the call. And Dr. Francis, that's all the time we have for today, but thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me along, Dean. All the best.
You too. Dr. Gavin Francis is a primary care physician and author of the book Recovery, The Lost Art of Convalescence. He talked with us about how we get better at getting better and how to resist the pressure to rush our body's healing process. And you can still let us know about your experience with healing or recovery. Email ideas@wpr.org. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, State Senator LaTanya Johnson wants to re-examine the process of how we issue Amber Alerts for missing children. We'll talk with her about what she wants to change and why. And Donald Trump is unlike any other candidate in the presidential race. We'll talk with a longtime political journalist about how she thinks the media could do better at covering the former president and what the media's role is in a presidential election. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to business development leaders from Wausau and Janesville about how communities across the state are filling out their retail storefronts in a tricky commercial real estate market. I'm Dean Kinetter in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.